Welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. Check out our website at www.thewildernessmedic.com.
Expedition resources, wilderness medicine blog, and much more.
Hello, welcome to the Wilderness Medic Podcast. This is the first episode of season two in 2021, and I'm really pleased to have Dr. Megan Evans join me today, and we're going to be talking a bit about what she's been up to at the DDRC healthcare facility in Plymouth with dive medicine. So yeah, welcome, Megan.
Hi, thanks very much for having me.
No problem. So I guess, yeah, we met almost a year ago up in Liverpool studying the tropical medicine diploma, and it's been a strange 12 months since then. I remember we were sort of sat at the back of the lecture theatre discussing various expedition plans, and I guess the rest is history. But since then, you've been working down in Plymouth, isn't it? Is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So, unfortunately, this last year has put a damp to some of the plans that I had. The trip abroad over the summer didn't quite go to plan. But I've been working down in Plymouth since August, working for DDRC, which, as you said, is a hyperbaric medical facility. So I'm working now in diving and hyperbaric medicine, which is super fun.
Yeah, that is really cool. And I'll be honest with you now, I don't know a huge amount about dive medicine. I actually have visited the DDRC when was it? A few years back, as part of the diploma in expedition and wilderness medicine, and we had a very kind of brief whistle stop tour of the facility and also some of the physiology surrounding dive medicine. At which point, my head probably exploded, I think. But I guess if you could tell people listening a bit more about the facility and what your day to day job involves, that would be really interesting.
Yeah, sure. So DDRC is a charity. They have essentially three kind of aims. So they do treatment using hyperbaric oxygen therapy for kind of a range of emergency and elective conditions. They're involved with education in the recreational and commercial diving communities. Trying to improve diver safety is a big focus. And they also get involved with research, both kind of on the diving side of things and on the hyperbaric medicine side of things. In terms of my day job, it's really, really varied, which I love. So we have the on-call phone line for the British Hyperbaric Association, which means that we kind of operate this 24-hour phone service. So any divers anywhere in the UK can phone up if they think they've had a problem, if they have any symptoms that they're concerned about, if there's been an accident. Speak to one of the doctors, myself, one of my colleagues at DDRC, and we're able to kind of either direct them to their nearest chamber or see them at our facility in Plymouth or give them advice over the phone or whatever it may be. So that's kind of the most exciting part of it, and certainly what got me interested in dive medicine, obviously treating the divers. But alongside that, we do a lot of elective hyperbaric work. So that involves receiving referrals and treating patients with hyperbaric oxygen therapy. And that can be for a range of different conditions. So non-healing wounds, radiation cystitis, osteoradionecrosis, all sorts of different bits and pieces. So a lot of my time as well is looking after our elective patients as well.
Well, that's really interesting. And I've got some interesting questions about, hyperbaric oxygen, maybe a bit later on. Because, it's a very interesting field, isn't it? And I suppose so if you were on call and manning the sort of the emergency phone, what sort of cases would you get coming through?
So tends to be more recreational divers that we get calling through the emergency line, just because commercial diving is so much more conservative in their limits and their protocols that they use. obviously to improve the diver safety and reduce the risk of accidents, which is...
Yeah, I guess prevention is always best if possible, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So the commercial sector has actually become much, much safer over recent years. So most of the calls that we get, I would say, tend to be the recreational divers. And it might be a diver themselves or a buddy or someone from a dive shop or a Coast Guard. I've received calls before from A&E staff saying, you know, we've had someone turn up in A&E with these symptoms, but they told me that they were diving the other day and you know, querying if it's a dive-related problem. So the variety is huge, really.
Yeah, that's really interesting. And how many other facilities are there like DDRC in the UK? Are there some, because I'm sure there must be other chambers and things.
Yeah, so I might get this, I might not get the exact number, but I think there are 9 or 10 chambers which are registered with the British Hyperbaric Association, kind of CQC approved and able to provide care for unwell divers as well as various kind of electives. But yeah, so not 9 or 10, I think there are.
Sure, yeah. And I guess obviously some of the time you're giving advice to various different places, and then I suppose what happens if someone comes into A&E and you think they have a dive related problem, what would be the next step then?
So it depends, obviously, as with all of medicine, on the patient and on the situation. Patients need to be stable for us to kind of see them and assess them. So kind of hemodynamically, cardiovascularly stable. We're not going to put someone in chamber if they're kind of peri-arrest. If someone's in A&E and they need urgent A&E treatment as a priority, then they'll receive that. But if they don't, if they are reasonably stable or if they've already received kind of their A&E treatment, what we would do is transfer them over to the Hyperbaric Centre, which in Plymouth with our centre, we're just right next to Derriford Hospital. Just around
that's,
the corner.
That's good, yeah.
Yeah, just around the corner from A&E. So get them in our centre and obviously assess them from a diving medicine point of view. So we would be looking at what was their dive profile, what happened, kind of what kit were they using, what depths were they at, what air were they breathing, all of these different things. Obviously their symptoms, a thorough assessment, examination, and hopefully if we do think that it is a decompression illness, hopefully we'll be able to get them in the chamber to recompress them, as soon as possible, because that's really where the benefit lies in these patients.
Yeah, and are the majority of the cases that you'd get, obviously because of the chamber, do they all tend to be to do with decompression sickness, or do you get any other kind of issues?
Sometimes we get cases where it's unclear as to whether the symptoms are a decompression illness or not, and it's not always very clear cut. Sometimes we might end up treating someone in the chamber who we think may have a decompression illness. And actually, if the symptoms were a bit vague to begin with and then they don't improve in the chamber, we might think, well, actually, maybe this wasn't a decompression illness. But at least they have had the assessment and they are at the right place.
That's interesting. Yeah. And I suppose for people who maybe don't know, what would be the kind of the main symptoms that you'd be looking for? Obviously decompression can affect all body systems, really, can't it?
Yeah, exactly. Decompression illness can affect the whole body depending on where the bubbles are in your body. But some of the most common ones that we see would be neurological symptoms and signs. So weakness, sensation changes. The other ones that are common are kind of limb pain. So you might have leg pain or joint pain, elbow pain, shoulder pain. Audiovestibular DCI, so people having balance problems, vertigo, nausea.
So I guess a lot of it can mimic sort of TAI stroke sort of things then.
Yeah, and sometimes it is hard to kind of make that call and think, okay, what's going to be the best for the patient? You know, do they need to go straight to A&E or do they need to come straight here? And you really just have to go off the clinical picture.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it comes back to all these things. It's the history, I suppose, isn't it? If someone has had a poor diving profile and they've just recently been diving, I suppose statistically they're more likely to have a decompression problem than it'd be bad luck to have a stroke at the same time, I suppose.
Yeah, and I think, you know, we focus a lot on the dive profile and the gas load that the patient has had. You know, if we're thinking that this is a decompression sickness, if they've had a very shallow short dive and they actually don't have the inert gas load on board, then it's impossible, and we're going to have to look at other causes for their symptoms. So yeah, obviously the dive profile and the dive history ties in with the clinical picture to kind of try and give you that idea.
Sure. So I guess from what you're saying, one of the main things you'd want to look at would be the duration of the dive then and the gas mix. And I guess also the depth that they went to and the speed that they sort of came up and whether they missed any stops, that kind of thing, is it?
Yeah, absolutely. Definitely if there was a rapid ascent, if there was some kind of problem during the dive, obviously that really raises our suspicion that this is decompression illness. Although it is worth noting that even people following perfect dive tables, they've not missed any stops, they've done a really lovely dive profile, you can still get decompression illness. You know, it's not a cut and dry rule that just because you've done a beautiful profile and followed all your stops that you're not going to get a bend. People still do. And I've seen people since starting who have absolutely followed lovely dive profiles. Nothing's happened, nothing's gone wrong. Nice slow ascent and they've still ended up with bends. So it's never a cut and dry thing, unfortunately.
Yeah, no, sure. Yeah, that's very interesting. I suppose what's been the highlights so far in terms of what you've been doing in DDRC with the dive medicine?
Oh, good question. I think I couldn't pick just one highlight, but in terms of working there, I really love the variety because, you know, on a typical day, maybe I've got an elective patient that I'm seeing first thing, and then I have a call about a diver. I might be doing some fitness to dive consultations as well, so talking to people about, you know, their medical conditions.
Like a medical kind of...
Yeah, and whether or not they can dive with certain medical conditions and things like that. So might have some dive consultations. We also do teaching on various different courses, so medical courses for kind of commercial divers and offshore workers. We do a lot of medical training with them as well. So I just absolutely love the variety.
Well, that sounds really interesting, yeah. And I suppose if we're kind of moving away maybe from the decompression chamber to maybe places that are a bit more remote, sort of like the expedition setting, because you've done a bit of work overseas, haven't you? Where I guess you don't have the luxuries of having you know, the decompression chamber. What's useful to know as a medic on a dive expedition, do you think?
Yeah, so I you're absolutely right. I did an expedition a couple of years ago in Madagascar where I was the medic for a group of divers out there, and unfortunately had another similar expedition to Indonesia cancelled last year because of the pandemic, but hopefully we'll be able to go this year. I think with expedition medics, anyone who's looking after divers really does need to concentrate on the planning side of things. And of course, that involves knowing where your nearest hyperbaric chamber is, what facilities they have. You know, is that a 24/7 service or are they only open 9 to 5 Monday to Friday? What language do the staff there speak, and do they know that there's an expedition nearby and they might be needed? Those things are really important. But also I would say from the fitness to dive aspect, you really need to make sure that all of your participants on the expedition are going to be fit to dive. And whilst I know that most organisations will have people fill out kind of a self-declaration questionnaire, I think it is worth making sure that you're happy, that people haven't kind of skipped over things or missed things out, saying, oh, well, I had childhood asthma, but I've not used my inhaler for ages, so I'll just tick no for that one. Because those are the kind of situations where I think it's really easy to then run into problems later down the line.
Yeah, I guess it's similar with lots of expeditions. There's that risk of just not doing your background work, isn't it? And people also not wanting to disclose things because they think it will stop them from being able to participate in the expedition or the dive and things like that. I suppose it's trying to share that discussion with them a little bit. And are there some good resources for people to sort of find that kind of information out if they're sort of starting off with trips?
So there are kind of various different places where you can do some kind of studying and reading and bits and pieces about dive medicine. I did an online module through the Royal College of Surgeons, Edinburgh. Their Faculty of Pre-Hospital Care do a remote and offshore medic kind of online course diploma. And one of their modules is a dive medicine module, which is very, very thorough in terms of lots of physiology and lots of proper hardcore science. So it is pretty intense, but that's really interesting. And then I think, you know, there are various different kind of dive expedition courses where you can, you know, get kind of hands-on practical skills, teaching from people who have been there and done it. So I know that obviously this is a bit of a cheeky plug from me, but we're actually running a dive expedition medicine course at DDRC, which is coming up in April. And it's exactly this. It's designed for people who are going out on expedition as a medic, who are going to be looking after divers. So, you know, we talk about decompression sickness, other diving related conditions, kind of a little bit of general expedition medicine, some bits and pieces about decompression and treatment, and yeah, really practical course. And I know there are other providers as well who do similar courses. So I think that's the best.
Well, that sounds really good, and I'd recommend. We'll put a link to that in the description of the podcast. Yeah, no, definitely. Mm-hmm. And so I suppose if someone in Madagascar or wherever someone might be on a trip, if they are, you know, they've done the course. We won't give the whole course away, but I suppose what would be the main key emergencies that they'd need to be able to handle, do you think?
So I think you need to have a really good understanding of the symptoms that you're looking out for in terms of anyone who's diving, and especially in a dive expedition, if you've got people doing daily or twice daily or three times daily dives for kind of days on end. Really any symptom that someone has, you need to think, could this be diving related? So having the awareness of how to kind of work out whether something is caused by the diving or not is really the first step. And then obviously, if you do think that someone has a diving related symptom, what do I need to do? What are the first things that we need to think about with this patient?
Sure, and I guess it comes back to, yeah, obviously if you're in somewhere tropical where a lot of these nice diving locations are, there's that whole differentials of from a tropical medicine point of view, then there's obviously the patient's background medical history, and I suppose you just have to, add diving sort of onto that, don't you, I guess, and then just manage them in a logical ABC sort of way and do what you can.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whilst kind of also thinking about the planning side of things, which I suppose comes back to what you were saying about having done your homework, knowing where you can transfer people to, and I suppose and how you can do it as well.
Yeah, and I think sometimes as well it's about having the confidence to say, okay, there's a symptom that I'm not quite sure about or that I'm concerned about. And instead of kind of sitting on it and waiting till the next day and seeing how it is, if it's less of a severe symptom, just having that confidence to say, no, you know what, this is a symptom that could be diving related. This person has been diving, therefore we need to evacuate them. Because I think sometimes that's the hardest thing when you're in those kind of environments.
Yeah, no, that's it. It's a difficult call because there's the kind of possible financial implications, but also potentially bringing the end to someone's trip as well, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And you know, it's a hard position to be in, and you've obviously got your expedition leader and hopefully some good support from the organisation as well. But at the end of the day, if you're the medic on the expedition, you kind of will be expected to have to really make that call and determine whether you think that this is a serious problem that needs evacuating. So definitely good to have that background knowledge and that kind of skill set before you go out.
And I suppose what are the main things that would usually have to be evacuated, do you think?
So anything that I suspected as decompression illness, I would evacuate. So whether that's some limb pain, whether that's some neurological symptoms, whether that's a rash that looks like a cutaneous bend, I think personally I would have quite a low kind of index of suspicion and threshold for evacuating patients, because you know I've heard about people who have had long-term disability from not being treated, and you know, particularly things like audiovestibular bends, people can be left with lifelong symptoms. Same with neurological bends. Obviously, if it's more significant, if it's more serious, then you know you've got a life-threatening situation. So, I think I would have quite a low threshold for evacuating, and with that as well, the knowledge that people, these cases, these patients can deteriorate reasonably rapidly. You know, you might have someone who is complaining of a little bit of tingling in their foot after a dive, and within a few hours, you know, they've got numb legs, and it can be that kind of rapid and severe. So yeah,
and I guess the two things that come to mind as a non-diver when I think of diving are ears and lungs.
Yeah, definitely know and be comfortable with looking in ears and examining ears. I mean, apart from the possibility of kind of audiovestibular bends or in a decompression illness, you've also got the problems with barotrauma and even just the tetanus externa. Skin as ear can be a real issue with diving expeditions, obviously, because it's just wet all the time. And yeah, lungs, I mean, especially this is where the fitness to dive side of things comes in, because you do definitely want to make sure that none of your participants have lung problems that are going to increase the risk of them developing pulmonary barotrauma and you know, decompression illness from that. So definitely really important.
One of the other things that I was wondering about on an expedition is do you think there's any issues with the quality of gas mixes when you go to some places compared with others?
Interesting question. I mean I've never personally had concerns about the quality. I'm an air diver, so I haven't ever done kind of nitrox or trimix diving. So really the question for an air recompression, what you want to know is it kind of pure and clean? And certainly contaminated gases can cause a lot of problems. As long as the compressor that where you're filling your tanks from is kind of in good working order and in a, you know, well ventilated area and bits and pieces like that, you should be all right. In terms of gas mixing. So if you're kind of using high oxygen mixes and different bits and pieces, then I think you've got to really have a great relationship with the organisation that you're diving with. And this goes obviously to all divers. You need to be able to trust whichever dive shop or dive organisation it is that you're diving with and that's filling your tanks. So whether that's checking beforehand their kind of accreditations, or whether that's reading reviews from other divers or what have you. But yeah, I think that is important. I've not personally had any problems so far, but definitely something to think about.
Yeah, and I guess just coming back to the hyperbaric oxygen side of things, and we touched on it sort of at the beginning that it can be used for sort of such a wide range of different conditions. I just wondered if either the DDRC or elsewhere, if you knew of any research that's happening with hyperbaric oxygen and to do with COVID or like long-term COVID lung injury, that sort of thing.
Yeah, there's been some research taking place in various different places, but particularly in the States and in the UK as well, actually using hyperbaric oxygen to treat COVID patients, you know, in the midst of their illness. And obviously, you know, COVID patients are profoundly hypoxic, so giving hyperbaric oxygen seems like it might be a sensible plan. And there has been, I think, some preliminary, fairly positive results. There was an American hyperbaric doctor who actually spoke at the British Hyperbaric Association conference, which was held virtually back in November, and she was talking about some work that she was doing treating COVID patients with hyperbaric oxygen. But I don't think that anyone, to my knowledge, has got to the stage of publishing data yet. But definitely something that people are looking at.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to sort of keep an eye out and sort of see how it evolves. Guess that sort of interest in physiology is going to accompany you to your next step of anaesthetics is what's on the cards next, is it?
Yes, that's the plan. I think that it ties in quite nicely, gases and physiology and things. So hopefully I'll be able to continue doing some diving and hyperbaric medicine alongside anaesthetic.
Yeah. No, definitely. I mean, it sounds like a good mix, and hopefully also better get out on an expedition to Indonesia or somewhere else fairly soon.
Fingers crossed.
I guess we're kind of coming to the end now, but it's been really good to catch up and also have a chat about dive medicine. I know it's a massive, massive topic, and we've only really kind of scraped the surface of a few little parts of it. So I'd encourage anyone who's interested to consider going on this course at the DDRC or any similar ones, and I'll post the links to what Megan was mentioning as well for the online modules at the bottom. So yeah, thank you very much for joining me, Megan, in episode one for this new set of podcasts. It's been really good.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. It's been great.
Awesome. Well, hopefully we'll catch up soon, maybe even face to face.
Yeah, that would be great.
All right, take care.
Cheers. Bye.
If you've enjoyed listening to our podcast, then check out our website, www.thewildernessmedic.com. If you're interested in being a guest on a future episode or writing a blog for us, then do get in touch, and don't forget to follow us on social media. Until next time, take care.